Hello again.
Hello to you. It's always awkward, that moment where we wait to see who's going to say hello first. It's like a game of kosher chicken.
Yes, except a kosher chicken would leave your presence for fear of ending up in soup.
I've got two massive pots of soup literally on right now.
Well, of course you do. How's it going?
It's going very well. I'm in a complete kerfuffle of travelling and doing different things on different days, like doing previews lots of the days and then doing other shows. And then randomly last night, not having anything to do. And I honestly couldn't have told you where I was in the world.
Have they gone well, the previews?
They're going all right. Apparently people like to chat to Jewish mothers. Who knew?
Well, I knew from any time you and I were in a cafe together. And I don't know if it's people liked talking to Jewish mothers or just that you put yourself in their world with no chance of escape.
That's a beautiful thing. How are you doing?
Well, here I am in your world with no chance of escape. I'm doing very well. I had a preview recently that was all right. Nice little prep for Edinburgh. There were five people in the audience, which I think probably is about right for Edinburgh. So yeah, just doing that, all the admin for the Fringe, family stuff, all good, all good.
Excellent. So amongst all those things and putting aside the inescapable situation of being connected to me, what's been the most Jewish thing that's happened to you recently?
So this is something that happened when I went to a Jewish school to do some promo bits for Schools Out Comedy Club, which is the children's joke show I did during lockdown. And I now go into schools and various other communities doing live shows where I host it and the kids come and they come up and tell jokes. And I've got a joke book that I sell to raise money for a charity called Fair Share. So it's all a lovely little time that I spend at the school. And when I was talking to one of the mothers afterwards, she was just making some small talk. I think it was getting quite awkward, really, because what do you really talk to people about? And
she was, question to ask me. Anything. Well,
exactly.
Everything.
Exactly. And I look at your situation and I think, how'd she do it? I mean, when I compare, this is the point of me doing a compare-y type show for Edinburgh called Shall I Compare Thee in a Funny Way? I can talk to anyone on stage, but if I see someone at the bus stop, I've got no interest in having a conversation with them, even if I know them. I'm very happy to pretend I'm listening to a podcast, even if I don't have headphones in. So anyway, I was chatting to this woman and she's very lovely, but she did that fairly typical Jewish mother thing of trying to ask about my life, am I married, my kids, job, whatever. And I said, this is what I do for a living. And she said, you do comedy for a living? I said, yes. She went, well, if it makes you happy. And it was such a backhanded Jewish mother type compliment. I was like, yes, actually, it does make me happy. But also, that's none of your business. I didn't say that, obviously. But it was
also, that isn't what that means, is it? As long as it makes you happy, it was, can you pay your bills? That's definitely the subtext.
Yeah, the subtext was all over the place. It was, can you pay your bills? Can you feed your family? Does your wife not mind having to support you during the tough times? Just such an odd thing. And also, I'm gonna find it bizarre anyway when you turn up somewhere to do a job of work and people are like, yeah, but what do you really do? Like, if someone came to my house to fix my drains, I wouldn't assume that was a hobby and they were actually an architect. It only seems to be our world that is something that people do.
People are sort of damning with faint praise about it, like, oh, that's nice.
It's also like when you tell someone you're doing a gig and they say, oh, is that paid? Like, yeah, that's how I make my living. That's how I buy stuff.
Yeah.
So that was my most Jewish thing. Rachel, how about you?
Well, I had a very exciting moment early in the week when I went to perform my show in Tunbridge Wells. I've never been to Royal Tunbridge Wells before. It's very nice. And it was a lovely, friendly audience. And out of the whole audience, there were two Jews, two older Jewish women. They were absolutely adorable. And what I really liked is, beginning of the show, I give out to the audience little slips of paper for them to write a question that they'd like to ask the ultimate Jewish mother. And out of everyone who's ever participated in that element of the show so far, which is happily a few hundred people, these two ladies wrote their full names on the top, like it was an exam, but also so that I'd know they were the Jews. It was really cute. You know, they had sort of Cohen-y, Goldstein-y surnames. Those aren't their surnames, I'm just saying, for protecting the innocent. But my most Jewish moment on Sunday during that show was when, in the show, I show a picture of comedian Aaron Levine eating a bagel that I gave him backstage. as part of showing how I have the reputation of feeding comedians at gigs, and it's part of my identity as a Jewish mother, which I think you would confirm is a thing that happens.
I would confirm, yes.
And when I held it up and it had like a hashtag that he'd written, Jewish mother, and then it said Beigel, and pause your thought for a moment, Philip, there, because the two ladies cheered when I said Beigel. And I said, what's that about? No, they cheered. I said, what's that about? And they said, you're the first person who's ever come to Royal Tunbridge Wells and pronounced it properly, because round here, no one knows what it is. They only know about bagels and they're wrong. And we're near Essex, we're near East London, we're very much a Beigel community, but there's so few Jews here, people don't even realise it. And they were so excited that they took a photo to put in their Jewish community newsletter, and that made me very happy.
The Jewish community newsletter. I'm happy that you found some allies. I really did, but I can't take any possible legitimacy from people that refuse to call the place they live Tunbridge Wells. It has to be Royal Tunbridge Wells. So I'm sorry, they're bagels.
I don't think they are. One of them, their question was, of what they would ask Ultimate Jewish Mother, their question was, how do we get more people to move from Golders Green to Tunbridge Wells? And I said, I'm just wondering why you specifically want people from Golders Green. Like, what's wrong with Boreham Woods? But that was where they thought all the Jews lived. So that's where they wanted everyone to come from.
So did they say why they didn't live in Golders Green? What brought them to Royal Tunbridge Wells?
I mean, obviously, I do know their entire life history now because I'm me. But I suspect you don't really want to hear it.
I've just remembered something, actually. Before we move on to talk about this week's episode, I had a message from someone this week about last week's episode. And I mean, it's not specifically about last week's, but we talked a lot about the fact that you have chicken souped a number of my family, including my mother, who was unwell recently.
Yeah.
And my family sometimes like to get quite competitive about who gets more mentions on the podcast than others. And I tend to know when they've listened because someone will message me with an update on whether they've been mentioned or not mentioned. So this is a message I got from my sister who lives in New York. Literally just says, please tell Rachel she hasn't chicken souped me.
If I go to New York, I will chicken soup you.
And I wanted you to know that because she's made it very clear that her Bruegus is with you.
So I said,
this is how I test who's listened to the show, by causing my own Bruegus. Bruegus's, I don't know, what's the plural? And she said, as long as we're clear, my Bruegus is with Rachel. So you are due to get a chicken soup delivery to New York, please.
I can make it happen. I just love the image of like your mum in an attic having a whole tally, like scoreboard thing of who's had what mentions.
I mean, I'm quite disturbed that your first image of my mother is in an attic.
No, I just mean like keeping it in a secret place, like in her loft where no one else
can see. Yeah, I know what an attic is. Just changing the name of it doesn't make that sentence any better. You have still banished my mother to the least insulated room in the house. We'll take that as a note to move on to talk about this week's episode. It's a funny one this week.
Yes, our guest was the brilliant American comedian Mark Schiff.
I think we've had a couple that have been heavier and fascinating as well as funny. This one is really interesting. Listening back to Mark talk to us about his Jewish journey and his love of rabbis. It was fascinating, actually. And I even had to share something of my own personal beliefs, which when I was listening back, my children were listening to it at the same time. I was on the school run. And I think they've now got a lot of questions about my my belief system. But yeah, it's a really lovely episode.
I'll tell you what I thought when I was listening back to it was I remembered that on that day you had a really bad headache, but we didn't want to cancel because we've been waiting to talk to Mark for a while. And so you took pills just before we started, and you can tell when in the episode your pills kick in because you're like really, really quiet and then you suddenly start joining in. And I just thought I'd forgotten that until I was listening back, that there's a point in which suddenly you're vocal, having been super mellow and quiet.
Yes, I do remember that moment when my body and my brain kind of kicked into gear and went, oh, I can be involved now.
Yeah, that was funny. So
enjoy listening. Thanks very much to Mark. It was really lovely to have him on the show. Check him out, go on to social media and check out his content as well, and
buy his books,
and we've put links to the books in the show notes as well, so plenty of homework for you guys to do after listening to the show. And get in touch as well if you would like to be chicken souped.
I'm Rachel Krieger.
And I'm Philip Simon. We are two Jewish comedians.
I'm Orthodox, so like the sun, I've always got my hat on.
And I'm Reform, so like the sun, I don't like it when people fly too close, and I'd rather you didn't look directly at me.
This show is the audio equivalent of climate change. Intelligent people believe in us, everything is our parents' fault, and we've given up doing anything by seasons.
In each episode, we chat to our favourite Jews about their lives and experiences growing up, and how much Jewishness plays a part. Are they embracing the heat? Or take your coat off, you won't feel the benefit when you get outside.
Welcome to Jew Talking to Me.
Let's introduce our guest, and this week we're chatting to a very funny man who tours with Jerry Seinfeld and has written for hit sitcoms like Roseanne and Mad for You. He's got a new book coming out called Why Not? Lessons on Comedy, Courage and Chutzpah. It's comedian and writer Mark Schiff.
Hello.
Hello there, Rachel. Hello, Philip.
Hello, how are you?
I call you Rachel instead of Rachel. What would you like?
Rachel is fine. All right, whatever tickles your fancy.
Okay.
And I'm happy with Philip.
You're fancy, Philip.
He's
sometimes
fancy.
But not midweek.
Okay.
One of our friends often calls him Phil, and it's very jarring.
Well, it's nice to be with you guys across the pond. I'm in Los Angeles as we speak.
What's the weather like over there?
So it's always 72 degrees, except the last couple of weeks it hadn't rained here in like years. We were ready to crack off, you know, the face of the earth. But now it's gorgeous. It's 72, and we're waiting for the big earthquake. That's what we wait for here.
In a way, we all are.
Yeah, there you go. So,
well, regular listeners to the podcast will know that we always like to find out how our guests self-define as Jews. So you probably already know that I'm Orthodox and Philip's Reform. But Mark, what kind of a Jew are you?
Fantastic question. And I go to an Orthodox shul. Mm-hmm. I go to a place called Young Israel of Century City. My rabbi is Elazar Muskin. He's a genius. So I go to an Orthodox shul, but I'm not 100%. Because of what I do for a living, which is stand-up comedy, there are some Shabbos as I work.
Right.
And it's always been, let me take that back, not always, but it's a thorn in my side.
Yeah.
But it's what I do, and it's how I earn my living, and I guess I don't have enough faith to say if I stop that God will take care of me. So that said, that's where I'm at.
Did you grow up in an Orthodox family?
No, Reformed. We went to a Reformed temple that was so Reformed, it was closed on Jewish holidays.
Oh, we should have sound effects for those.
Yeah. No, my parents, they went for Yisker, you know, like twice a year. And
just like the memorial prayers.
Yeah, memorial prayer for their parents who had passed on, and sister, brother. I went to synagogue with them, maybe, you know, Yom Kippur or something. But this is where the story is kind of interesting. My first 3 years, my parents sent me to an Orthodox yeshiva in the Bronx in New York.
Right. So a religious school.
Yeah. Very religious. Black hat rabbis with the long beards and the long coats. And those are just the women. So he sent me to, you're a good crowd.
Thank you. They sent me, practice.
Sent me to this yeshiva, not because of religion, but it was like a daycare center. It was a place, yeshivas keep you late, much later than public school. Public school in America lets you out 2 o'clock, 3 o'clock, and my parents work full time, so they couldn't afford a babysitter. So they sent me this yeshiva, and I didn't get out till like 5:30, 6 o'clock. And by the time I got home, my mother was already home from work, except on Fridays. There we got out at 1 p.m, mm-hmm. and the bus would drop me at a coffee shop on my corner. And I would sit, they would babysit me in the coffee shop. These were really nice guys that owned it, this guy, Julie, and I sat in the back on a stool until my parents came home. My mother came home around 5 o'clock, and they fed me lunch. And I kind of learned how to cook by watching the Short Order cook.
Wow.
Yeah. So it's pretty cool. So I got my first 3 years going to an Orthodox school, and then I fell in love with rabbis.
All rabbis or a specific rabbi?
No, I just love rabbis. Yes. Well, now that I know something, yeah, there are specifics. One from your area, Jonathan Sachs, of course.
Good choice. You know,
the Rebbe here, my rabbi, a lot of them. But I've always liked listening to talks, and especially rabbis. Mm-hmm. Interesting enough, last night I went to, for the first time in my life, the breaking of fast for Ramadan. It's the fifth day of Ramadan, and one of my close friends is a Palestinian Muslim, and we found a way to become friends and really help and care about each other and bridge the gap. So he's come to a couple of bar mitzvahs at my shul, two of my son's bar mitzvahs. He's come to a Sukkot at my house. And I just went to Ramadan with him.
What was it like?
It was really nice. They had a couple of speakers talk, you know, very, you know, nice, loving stuff, you know, about peace and love. And it didn't get political. There's no anti-Israeli stuff. There was no nothing. They were just, these are young Muslims that have good careers, seem to believe in America and want to fit in. So it was really nice. I guess if I sat down and talked to them individually, we could get into some discussions, but none of that happened last night.
I don't know if it had like a vibe like the Yom Kippur breakfast where everyone's like pouncing on the food. And
well, there, that's true. But it's 30 days. So they fast every day for 30 mm-hmm. days, but they don't do the full Yom Kippur fast. They right. start in the morning. So it's about a 12-hour fast, I believe.
Right.
And it's every day. And then they joked about it. You know, like when they have a kiddush at the shul, people, you know, they find dead people on the floor from being stepped on and people killing each other for some challenge. So they did talk about that. They said, you know, there's four in line, so you don't have to kill each other to get to the hummus. So just take it easy, folks. Every religion has that. Put out a bucket of food, people go nuts.
What was the food?
So they had hummus, Israeli salad, stewed tomatoes, you know, the Syrian rice, you know, the brown, the cooked burnt rice and stuff like that. All of that was parv. And then they have their meat. And I'm a vegan.
Right.
So I don't need any animal products, anything. I don't need anything that had a face or a mother. If it had a face, I'm not going to eat it. But it was nice. It was. You know what it looked like? It looked like some Jewish spread. It was the exact same spread you see at some Syrian or Farsi situation. Exactly the same.
Did they call it Israeli salad?
Interesting enough, I didn't ask, and they did not call it Israel. They called it occupied salad. That's what they called it. But you know, I did a joke about my friend Maz once. I had a party. They had a party for me for my birthday, and I usually don't do Palestinian Muslim jokes. He doesn't do Jew jokes, and I don't do. But I couldn't help this one. I said, in honor of Maz, the bathroom at the restaurant, they took off the occupied sign, and it just broke up the house like crazy. They just and Maz was very appreciative. So anyway.
That's beautiful. So I was actually about to ask you what the most Jewish thing that's happened to you recently is. It kind of feels that this almost could have been it anyway, because you're going to break a fast with someone who you've previously taken to festivals that are all about food, whether it's Sukkot, whether it's, you know, a bar mitzvah, it's all about the food and the meal. Mm-hmm. And here you are going to break the fast with your friends. But other than that, is there anything else that's happened recently that's particularly Jewish?
Yeah, so my new book, Why Not? Lessons on Comedy, Courage, and Chutzpah came out. And the book appeals to everybody. But until I wrote the book, I didn't actually know how Jewish I was. I mean, and that's a weird thing to say. I didn't know how much I cared. I didn't know I cared so deeply about being a Jew. I knew I cared deeply, but I didn't know it was as deep as when you write. It's different than just speaking.
Mm-hmm.
It's a much deeper, it goes from, they say, the heart through the arm out the pen, you know? So I learned a lot, and I wasn't sure how the Orthodox community would rally around this book. And everybody did, from the Reform to the Conservative to the, you know, I sold so many copies to the Orthodox, and I got beautiful emails from Rebbetzins and very religious people. So that was a very Jewish thing. I didn't know how it would touch these people, but it did. So that was very meaningful to me.
What was the reason you thought it wouldn't impact on the religious community?
That's a good question. You know, a lot of religious people, and I'm not talking about modern Orthodox, but they don't leave this comfort zone of reading,
mm-hmm.
especially in with the Chassid, you know, you're not going to find them reading a dime novel or books like mine. Even people like one of my favorite rabbis that changed my life, I never met him. His name was Abraham Joshua Heschel.
Yeah.
Greatest rabbis that ever lived. The Orthodox don't think much of him. They don't talk much about him. So if they're not going to talk about Heschel, I wasn't so sure they were going to talk about me. He changed my life with a book called Man Is Not Alone.
That's a very famous book.
Yeah, he proved to me there was God. I always believed in God anyway, but reading that book, I walked away from that book going, there's no doubt about it.
I've got my fingers crossed.
Wow, fingers crossed. Knock on wood.
I've not read it. And, you know, and now I'm almost scared to.
So he was a poet, and it's lyrical, the book. It talks about awe. I'll tell you what I got out of it. quick line. So he said, you know, these days, you know, people, they believe in nature, they believe in the ocean. And he said he can never pray to anything that he didn't feel could understand his emotions. That's why he couldn't pray to a rock or a tree. That some people believe in trees and rocks. And he said, I can't pray anything that doesn't have an emotional level. And he believed that this creator who created his emotional level understood emotions. So therefore, that's why he could pray to this being.
There's a writer called Naomi Regan. She's a Jewish American writer. And in one of her books, I think it's Jeffrey's Daughter, there's a story about how the main character, she looks at different things, and the way she believes in God is because she looks at, I think it's the pattern of a snake's skin, like she's a snake and she thinks that pattern can't be just the result of a spontaneous bang in the sky. Whatever, that was like her take on it. And it's it was a very beautiful passage about how nature influenced her to think there must be a creator. The Heschel School in New York, I've had quite a few friends who've had their kids at that school.
There's a Heschel School out here in North Hollywood.
Well.
And most people who send their kids there don't know who Heschel was.
Right, wow. Everyone should do more revision. That's what I say.
I'm almost on Amazon looking at these books.
There are two books I suggest, Man Is Not Alone and The Sabbath.
Philip, I'll buy them for you for your birthday.
Philip, you had said something. It was interesting. Are you not a believer in God?
I'm not. No, my background is Reform. I am socially and culturally Jewish, but I'm not a believer.
Right.
And I've been through many, I guess, journeys. So I started off Reform, very much a believer. And when I knew I wanted to be an actor before I started stand up, I was remember thinking, wherever I am in the country, wherever I'm working, I'll find a synagogue if it's Shabbat and I'll go. You know, I was quite not devout, but I was interested. And then as I got older, I became significantly more cynical and stopped believing. Some of it was just personal stuff that was going on in my life at the time. Some of it was just, I suppose, more of an understanding of the world around me and science. And, you know, I'm not hugely knowledgeable, but I tended just to believe the science rather than the religion. And now I'm involved. I talk about it a lot in my work, and I work with Jewish communities quite a bit as well anyway. So I would say socially, culturally, professionally Jewish is how I would define it.
I understand. But no matter what it is, we're all 100% Jewish. So
sure, yeah.
We're all exactly the same.
Yeah, my children go to a Jewish school, which is partly coincidence and partly by design. Whether they'll continue that into high school, I don't know. But at the moment, in primary school, they are. I'm not anti-religion. I'm not all Jews. There are a few I don't like, but not because they're Jewish.
Me too.
It just doesn't help.
Yeah, me too. I know a guy that says he's FFK, from kids. His kids got religious, and then they sucked him into it.
Yeah, yeah. That's a thing.
Yeah.
I can't imagine that's going to happen for you, Philip, with your kids.
Well, you say that. My youngest, who is currently six, the other day, I did overhear him. He was sitting on the toilet. He's not yet learned how to close the door when he goes to the toilet. And he was reciting the Shema, which is obviously learning in school. And I did have a moment of partly proud that he's learning from school and he's following a tradition, because although I'm not a believer, I do like the traditional elements of it. And also I was thinking, how difficult is this poo that he's got to pray?
My now nearly 18-year-old son, but when he was probably similar age, maybe like 5 or 6, he used to sit on the toilet and sing, Hashem is here, Hashem is there, Hashem is truly everywhere. Like, he'd obviously been taught that God is all around. Even when you're on the toilet, I imagine someone in the class would have asked that question, because we all ask that question at that age. Like, when you say everywhere, do you mean everywhere? Like, even in the bathroom?
That would be my oldest son.
Wow. Yeah. By the way, I had a kid, my middle kid, he left that bathroom door open too. We would beg him to close it, and he just refused to do it. And he was about 6 or 7.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. It's a thing. It's a thing. But the praying was confusing.
He actually could not go to the bathroom unless he took all his clothes off. It was the weirdest thing. He was
just a boy thing. Out of that.
Is it a boy's thing? Yeah, I got 3 boys, but he was the guy that did this. We just walked by, he's just completely naked on the toilet. And it was just the funniest thing in the world. So.
Well, I'm glad we've had that deviation into our children and toilets. Fascinating. I'm sure everyone will love listening to that bit. But we know that we're living in very tumultuous times. So we always like to check in with our guests and ask them, What's the matter, Bubala? So what is grinding your gears at the moment, Mark Schiff? What's getting on your nerves? What's bugging you in life and the world right now?
That's a good question. I don't know if I have a funny answer for that.
It doesn't have to be.
So I write essays, like my book, Why Not? Lessons on Comedy Cards, which is about 60 essays. And that book is out and I've continued writing. Mm-hmm. And yesterday there was a school shooting here.
Yeah.
They shot this woman. She shot 3 9-year-olds and 3 60-year-olds, killed them. So I sat down to write an essay. I don't generally write. I have some serious essays in my book, but I felt I was at a fork in the road yesterday. It stopped me in my tracks. You know, there's been a lot of killings, but this one for some reason stopped me. And I felt I had to make a decision whether to bury it deep within me and forget about it. Or the choice I was looking at was to open my heart or seal it up like a stone. And so that's something that really got to me. And I started writing the story yesterday and I went back to it today to write it. And I wrote for a little while and I jumped off it to write some comedy. It's very difficult. It's a very difficult time here. What's going on in the country? So that combined with the craziness across the world with Ukraine and the potential for a nuclear war, it doesn't keep me up at night, but we're at a very strange place now in the world. A very strange place. The good news is the worse the world gets, the more people want to laugh.
Mm.
It's a unique sort of pendulum. It swings horror, laughter. And I've had some of the best audiences ever now because they're very worried. And what a comedian gets to do is gets them to forget about it for a few minutes. And I don't do any politics. I don't curse. I work very clean. I even have hair, by the way. I'm wearing a hat, but I just want to show you something. People think I don't have hair. I have a lot of hair. I have as much hair.
Me too. I have the same thing.
When I went back to my high school reunion, which was public school, I asked people, what's the one thing you remember most about me? They said, you always wore a hat. That was a throwback from my yeshiva days, first 3 years. I wore a kippah and I've never not had something on my head ever since I was a little kid.
Mm. That's so interesting.
Yeah, I've kept that minhag. And unless I'm doing a Jewish gig, I don't wear anything on stage. I go up. I don't want them questioning, you know, and I don't want to get into why this guy has a yarmulke on. You know, I leave that out of it. But in life, all the time, I always wear a hat or a yarmulke.
That's so interesting to me because I cover my hair all the time because I'm Orthodox. And it's the first thing I address when I go on stage. Is that I've got a hair covering.
As a comedian?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, yeah. Part of my opening bit is about, you know, the fact that this isn't a pirate thing. It's a Jew thing. I'm not ahoy, right. I'm oive, but I'm just one of the blonde ones who's allowed to live amongst you. But I have like a whole load of material about covering my hair because when you have a thing, it's nice to address it. Like it's there in the room, so it's nice to address it. But I thought it was interesting what you said before about during the really dark times and how people feel about comedy. You're swinging between horror and laughter because I found people, particularly like during the pandemic, but also if you gig for example, for cancer charities, they want you to either be super confrontational about the issue. Like even in the pandemic, people loved the comedians who were really dark about the pandemic or where it was just kind of light and fluffy and nothing to do with anything, right. Just a bit of observational fun. Mm-hmm. And I think that's really interesting about how people work when things are tough.
Well, it's important to mention what's going on. I mean, not like horror things like, you know, war in Ukraine. See, the war that's going on over there doesn't affect the whole world. Most of the world doesn't think twice about it. But the pandemic, everybody was there. I have my opening joke these days. I go, nice to be here in front of an audience. It's good to be out again, right, folks? You know, we're all out again. We're not locked up like in prison. I said, I spent 2.5 years locked in with my wife. Every room I went into, she was there. I walked into the bedroom. There she is. Walked into the living room. She's there. I opened the refrigerator. She's sitting in the refrigerator. So I just get it out about the pandemic a little bit.
Mm-hmm. It's a thing that brings everyone together, I guess.
Yeah. Well, it's important for a comedian to make mention of whatever situation, like whatever town you're in, or I think...
We're the connecting point, aren't we? Because a lot of people have the feeling about whatever it is that's going on locally for them. And we have come into their town to tell some jokes. And we might be the connecting point between what's going on in the wider world or just the escape, the chance for them not to think about what's going on locally as well. But the pandemic was something global that everyone was directly affected by. So that is something. And it's not even that political to talk about it.
No, it's not. Unless you go down that route and I start talking about Fauci or, you know, the crazy scientist, you know, no, none of that.
Because I've been doing a lot of shows lately where they said you can't do any politics, no politics whatsoever, but you can get away with hints towards it. So with the pandemic, you know, I go a little bit like you did about how great it is to be back. And I say that, you know, comedy was illegal for a while. Live comedy was illegal. I couldn't do it. I had to stick to the rules because I'm not in the cabinet. Right. And you can get away with that because it's not specifically saying this person.
Yeah, I understand.
But everyone understands that rules were broken and we all did what we were told up to a point. Even our neighbors broke rules, even our friends broke, you know, you're telling your story, but it's very much their story as well.
So could you have done a joke like, you know, Boris Johnson goes to the same barber as Donald Trump? Because he had that wild hair, right, Boris Johnson?
Yeah.
The man had the worst haircut in the world, worse than Donald's.
Yeah, the problem is Boris's haircut became the distraction that people spoke about, so they weren't talking about the actual politics.
Behavior.
That's why they really got rid of him. It wasn't any of the politics. It's because of that haircut. They couldn't stand it. He was bringing down the country with that hair. England is a hip place where people dress nice. And then you got the guy in charge of the country with a haircut like that. You don't want this guy.
No.
You're better looking than this guy.
If only we'd have realized many years ago that we didn't want this guy.
Yeah.
One of the problems we've had with telling jokes like that, I guess, whether it's about Trump or Boris Johnson, is the audience then gets very defensive if they are supporters of Boris or Trump.
Sure.
Which is they feel that you, as you know, a London elite, have come to their club and started telling them that all their life choices are wrong. So sometimes it's easier to avoid it. Sometimes it's easier just to say, I don't care, these are my jokes, I'm going to tell them. But people have got very, very defensive, and I think the nation has as a whole, and I'm sure it's the same in America, has got very divided in how it feels about politics. And because of social media, they feel empowered to speak their mind and try and cancel somebody or try and get people taken off social media, things like that.
Right. And it's really funny. They have a very loud voice, but it's a very small group of people. And these cancelers have absolutely no sense of humor. They are the turd in a punch bowl. They have nothing going for them. It's so sad that people garner their wisdom now from 20-year-olds. It's flipping insane.
It's 20-year-olds who weren't even in the room where the jokes were being told. They're seeing it on social media,
which
is not the place for stand-up comedy. You know, we do it live in a club.
They're not stopping anybody. The comedians that are out there talking are talking like crazy and selling out thousands and thousands of seats. Bill Burr, you know, all these guys, you know, he says whatever he wants. It's not an issue.
The thing is, yeah, people keep talking about cancel culture, but we can all still say whatever we want. There are just sometimes consequences of that, and they're consequences that didn't exist 20 years ago, because let's say if I said something horrifically offensive on stage 20 years ago, then the people in that room might tell their friends, you know what, I didn't enjoy her set, let's not go and see her tour, whatever it is, that'd be the end of that. Maybe if they saw I was going to be on a TV show, they wouldn't watch it. Chance would be a fine thing. But whereas now you can rally an international campaign in 10 seconds flat, where everybody knows about it. And it's just that old word of mouth thing. Instead of people saying, having a conversation, yeah, I didn't really like her, or I like this bit, I didn't like that bit. There's no nuance to everything. It's just you're good or you're bad. And that's the end of that.
That's right. That's right. It's very sad. One person could shut down a whole... I was thinking of trying to shut down Apple, part of Apple.
Okay.
So everybody's shutting down people these days. So, you know, you're at the Genius Bar.
Yeah.
You know, the Genius, do they have that?
Yeah.
So how dare they call these people geniuses and label everybody else that works for them idiots, right? I mean, it's shocking that, you know, you're talking to someone that works at Apple in the store and you go, I'd like to see a genius, not you, writing Apple and telling them and see if they will shut down the Genius Bar and just make everybody the same.
But also it's not just us saying we'd like to see a genius. It's they've managed to degrade the person who you speak to originally to say, you don't want me. You want a genius.
That's exactly it. They're degrading everyone else that works for Apple.
Yeah.
Except who they have deemed is smarter. But the truth is, we want a genius. Like when you go see a doctor, you want to see, you know, like some schlep that came in last in his class. You want to see a flipping genius.
Yeah, 100%. Right? I like the fact, what's his name? The guy behind Apple. Is it... I never remember who any of the people are. I can't do names. But presumably they're not a genius because they don't work in the Genius Bar.
They don't, you're right. They don't work in the Genius Bar.
I mean, you could say that they don't need to work in the Genius Bar anymore.
I mean, I imagine they don't need to work anywhere. Realistically, yeah. They're probably okay.
Well, you know, I've talked to these Apple guys. I went into Apple last week, right? I had a problem with syncing up my computer with my phone. And the guy fixed it in a minute. He was from the Genius Bar. And I said, you are a genius. And he goes, not really. I go, no, you are. You're a genius. That's why you work in the Genius Bar.
Did it make sense?
I've said to him, how do you feel to be a genius? He goes, you know, it was hard to get an answer.
I don't think you can be a genius and be self-deprecating.
It's hard. You got to be arrogant. Geniuses are arrogant. Yeah. Was Einstein arrogant?
Must have been.
Within
his field. Like, he's like Sheldon Cooper. He's not going to, you know, be, oh, no. I'm sure you guys are wonderful too. No, he knows he's a genius.
I wonder if Einstein's wife ever said to him, you know, enough with that haircut. You know, you look like Boris Johnson. He was the predecessor to Boris Johnson.
I love when our show has callbacks.
Yeah. Callbacks. I'm actually a callback king. When I do an hour set, maybe I have like 10 callbacks. And sometimes I invent them right on the spot. Like I'll be in the middle of the act and I'll go, it's time to bring this back. I've never brought it back, but I know it fits perfectly here. Callbacks are fun. It also gives the audience, they feel that the act is alive. You know, like they participated in this part and now you're reminding them. It's a very cool thing to be able to do.
Yeah, it's the last 5-10 minutes of all my hour shows that always call back. Yeah, for the same reason, it makes it feel like we're all in it together because we all remember right. that conversation. Yeah. It's a nice thing.
Well, I have a callback of my own now because you mentioned that your wife was sat in the refrigerator. And I know that at that point, Rachel immediately went into Jewish mother mode and wanted to know what food you had in your fridge. But we want to know what Jewish foods you're into. Do you have a particular Jewish memory, something, a meal you had as a child or a particular favorite Jewish food, anything you'd like to share?
So, yeah, right now, if you looked in my refrigerator, you would think we were incredibly poor. You know why? Come on.
I mean, because you're getting ready for Passover. So it's quite empty.
That's right. There's, you know, my wife about 3 weeks ago, she said, do not buy anything new. No more new stuff. Just fruits and vegetables. Otherwise, we got to go through everything. And I'm scraping the bottom and I got like 2 jars in there. It looks like nobody lived here for years. So yes, because of Passover. So in the refrigerator, Jewish-wise, I think there's some potato pancakes, frozen potato pancakes. Well, I have my kosher pickles all the time. Bubby's kosher pickles.
Oh, thank goodness.
Yeah. And I get the sauerkraut, which I love. But I get that from Trader Joe's, but it has a nice Heckscher on it. But there's a knish place in New York called Yonah Schimmel.
Okay.
In there since,
you want to
like,
explain what a knish is for people who aren't familiar with it?
Let's say it's a potato knish. It's like this mashed up potato with some onions and some celery and some salt and pepper. And it's made into like the thing. And then they bake it. And it has a crispy shell on the outside. It's sensational. And this place, Yonah Schimmel, they make mushrooms, spinach, kasha. And they've been doing it since 1920s. And whenever I go to New York, I bring some back with me. It's like living in another world. I also like, of course, I make my own hummus.
Do you?
Yeah,
there's a conversation because I make my own hummus and I it's never quite creamy enough. What's your recipe? How do you do it?
Well, you got to add water to it.
Yeah, that's it. See.
That's the deal. You got to water it until it's not too watery, but it's otherwise it's like wallpaper paste.
Yes.
So
it's a fine line.
I have a pressure cooker. And I cook my own garbanzo chickpeas myself. I make them myself. I don't try not to get them out of a can. And then I just use tahina, 100% tahina with no oil, no salt. And then I use some lemon, some garlic, salt, pepper, maybe a drop of cayenne pepper and a little bit of water. And it is phenomenal. It is phenomenal. And then if you really want it tasting good, warm it up before you eat it. I learned that in Israel when I went into an Arab quarter there and they had warm hummus and warm pitas. It's insanely good. So next time you got some hummus, just warm it up for about a minute in the microwave or something, cover it, and you will see you'll fall in love with it. Oh, and I put some paprika on it, smoked paprika.
Okay.
I'm still thinking about the warming up.
Warm up the hummus. You warm up the hummus and try it, and then you will email me and thank me.
I've never warmed up hummus, but I think it could work because I do like it when they take a bowl of hummus and they put like shawarma in it or something. And the heat of the two together with the hummus. It's one of my favorite things to do is just dipping pita bread in the hummus and the heat of those two work. I don't use my own chickpeas. I do open them from a can, but I do skin them. What's that? Nope.
Yeah, take the skin off, peel them.
I de-skin them, which is quite an arduous.
I don't do it. Why do you skin them? I never do that.
Because when I didn't, it made the hummus really quite lumpy and claggy. And then someone said, a video on TikTok told me to try to skin them. And it was incredible. It made such a difference.
And do you put it in a blender or a food processor?
Yeah.
And it's still lumpy.
Yeah. Well, claggy, not lumpy. It was just a much thicker texture.
You can leave the skin on and you just add water.
Maybe I'll do half and half.
Saving you an hour and a half of your life.
You are. It does take that long.
I skin beets, you know, like when I roast beets or boil beets, then you got to take the skin off of those and it comes right off once it gets cold. You just...
Yeah.
So I actually, if I wasn't going to become a comedian, one time when I was real little, I was thinking of going to culinary school.
Oh, wow.
I'm a latchkey kid, if you know what that is. I would come home and cook for my parents and hang out by myself. So I learned to cook really young. I do all my own cooking too. My wife won't cook for me.
Is there a special meal you've ever made for her? Like if you're going to make her a romantic dinner?
Yeah. I'll tell you something, what I do. I make her breakfast every day. Every day. What I learned is, so my wife never says to me, you never do anything for me, which I think a lot of times women like to say to a lot of guys, you never do anything for me. I'm doing it. So anyway, I make a breakfast every day, so she can never say, you never do anything for me. That's one reason. And I also do it because it's one of the first things I do in the morning is I try to do something for somebody else. It's a really nice thing to do. So I buy the fruit, fresh fruit. So I make her fruit, like a fruit plate. And then I make a blender drink. And I have a lemon tree in the back that gives lemons almost the whole year. And I squeeze fresh lemon juice and I mix that in some water for her.
That's very healthy.
Very healthy. And the interesting thing about this, are you guys married, both of you? I don't know.
Yeah, not to each other. To other
Definitely,
people.
Yeah.
Okay. So, you know, certain times in marriage, like you hate the person.
I could not possibly agree with you.
Okay, yeah. You just like, I can't take this. So in the morning, even if I hate her, I still do a nice thing for her. So it's an interesting thing. You're kind of usurping these negative feelings by doing something. You may slam it down. Here's your drink, you know, but so it's an interesting thing to do something for somebody you're unhappy with at the moment.
How long have you been married?
It's my second day. No, 33 years, just past 33 years. It went by like 10 minutes underwater.
If I had to spend my day doing things for people I didn't like, I'd never get anything done for myself. There's such a list.
I agree with you. Yeah.
Well, I mean, I'm coming up for my 30th wedding anniversary and we've got a good arrangement where I cook and he washes up. And everybody's happy.
We have that arrangement too. I'll dry all the dishes and stuff like that. I don't mind. And I will do the dishes. It's taken her 25 years to teach me how to stack the dishwasher. She has a system and she wants me to follow the dishwasher system to perfection. Yeah. Like one size plate on this side, another size bowl on this side, everything but the knives go standing up, the knife goes down. It's very complicated. It's E equals MC squared with the dishwasher here.
Philip, you are definitely like that.
Well, we have a very good system with our dishwasher. I stack it and then she restacks it. And sometimes I don't even notice, but she does. Same with folding socks, because we've only been together, well, we've been together 10 years, but we've married 7 years and we met later in life. And when we got together, we'd obviously lived separately and you get used to doing things a certain way. But I soon found out that I'd been folding socks wrong and he was very happy to try and educate me. But we can't agree on socks. So I fold my socks. She folds her socks.
What's the difference?
I'll tell you what it is. And it's come to a head recently because in the sale, I bought some day of the week socks.
Right.
So on the foot of the sock, it says the day of the week, right, which means if you ball it up completely, you don't know what day of the week it is.
Right. You could look on Facebook, ask a question. People will tell you.
I don't have that on my socks. But so I fold my socks, not because of these. I just always did fold my socks a little bit. You just fold it down. The whole thing's dangling. You can see everything. It's fine. She does them in a lovely ball. Beautiful. I'm not knocking the talent. No.
Talent is talent.
But it's a ball and you can't see the bottom of the sock. And it's only recently that I was able to say to her, this is why you can't fold my socks.
Wow.
So I would have to undo potentially 7 pairs of socks in order to get to the right ones.
Wow.
If only Alanis Morissette had included that line in her song.
I mean, it's not ironic, is it? It's just bloody annoying.
Lenny Bruce used to talk about women that wore the wrong day of the week panties. They would have like Tuesday on like a Thursday, and it used to drive them crazy. I know what you're saying there. My wife, one of the problems with my wife is I feel she's a dictator, and I live in her country. She runs a very small country here, and she watches me a lot. Tremendous amount of looking at what I'm doing, and it's I've asked her not to. And she also can hear what I'm doing. She's very good. She's like in another room. She can tell that I'm touching something. It's a very weird. Do you have that talent?
Yes, I do. We're born with it. Jewish women, we're born with it. But also my kids, they had kind of willful hearing. So if you called them for something they didn't want to do, they couldn't hear it. But if you opened the wrapper of something, doesn't matter where, we don't have a massive house, but we have a few rooms and an upstairs and a downstairs. I don't want to show off. They could hear the slight crinkle of the edge of a packet or something that they want. From honestly, if they were in another city, they'd be on a bus home. They can hear that.
That's so funny. Yeah. I do a routine now. I'm just starting to do about how my wife, she thinks I'm deaf. All women think their husbands are deaf. My wife will talk to me in a very low voice from 3 rooms away, with all the doors closed, and expect me to hear this. Mm. And then when I go in and I'll say, what did you say? She goes, if you didn't hear the first time, I'm not repeating it.
My husband has a thing that he says, you know, like when people play poker and they have a tell. So he has a way of saying pardon or sorry, or, you know, could you repeat it? I don't remember the exact phrasing, but whenever he says that, he has heard, he's just buying time before the answer.
Ah, don't we learn?
Because we observe, we notice this stuff. It's interesting because I think Jews, we quite like arguments. We quite like that. I think the sport of falling out or being annoyed with people, I think that's quite genetic. You know, we love a broigus, like a real proper petty grudge that you can hold for like a million years, so long that you don't remember what caused it. And I'm just wondering if you've got a favorite broigus of falling out that you've experienced that you could share with us.
My family would hold on to, and I actually never understood that, but they would hold on to grudges long after a person is dead. You know, they would curse them in the grave, that son of a, I'm glad he's dead. And I never quite understood that. Somebody that did something to someone a long time ago. There's something about forgiving. You don't have to forget. I have a thing now with a guy. You know, you get older and you don't want to deal with nonsense as much as you were willing to, I think, when you're younger. At least that's my experience. And I got this guy that it's very polarized now in the United States. If you voted for this guy, this one hates you. So I have a friend that was on a different side of the tracks than I was. And he started sending me like hate emails. I know the guy for 50 years and saying, you know, you're cruel. How can you vote for this guy? You're mean. Yeah. And I gave him permission. I said, listen, I'm going to forgive that one. And then he did it again. And I forgave him again. And then he did it again. And I'm not talking to him anymore. But now, interesting enough, I find out he's incredibly depressed and going through a real life crisis. So I had to make a decision. Should I put away that nonsense that him sending me those emails and see how he's doing? And I chose to make the call to him. And we had a conversation. I don't want to spend a lot of time talking to him, but then I called him back and he hasn't returned my call, which is okay because I tried to reach out to him. So I was able, for a higher reason, put away this thing that I felt he had done.
That's good to take the better path because someone's having a hard time.
You know, I believe this is something I really do believe in. If there is a God, which I believe there is, one of the things that he wants is for his children to work things out. That's a big deal. And any ground that you can clear up an ancient wound is holy ground. So I try to live like that. I try to keep a clean slate if at all possible. And there are some things in life you can't ever clean up, but you do the best you can. So that's who I believe. That's one thing. I don't know a lot about God, but I know that's one thing that I'm pretty sure that he's into is people, you know, righting wrongs.
That's a beautiful answer.
And certainly, I guess, righting them before it's too late, because
yeah,
it's all very well to hold a grudge beyond someone's lifetime. but you can't fix it after that.
I've written about it. There are people who tell people, you had a bad relationship with your mother, father, and they're dead. Write a letter and go to the grave and read it to them. Okay, it's helpful, maybe, but it's not the same thing as clearing it up when they're alive.
Mm.
Do it now.
Great answer.
I'm just waiting for our listeners to come back. They've all gone to resolve things with their parents. I'll be back in a moment. Good advice.
You know, with parents, everybody has issues. And as you get older, if you're lucky, you gather something called empathy, especially if you get kids. If you got kids, then you realize what your parents went through. Unless you don't have kids, it's hard to understand. I had a lot of issues with my parents, but I also caused them a lot of heartache. And I didn't realize that until later on in life.
I mean, my kids are a handful. I've got 2 boys, 8 and 6. They are an absolute handful. And I look back at my own childhood with my parents. I was one of 4. It was boy, girl, similar 2-year gap-ish between each of us. And I look back at having gone through what I'm going through with my children. And every time I see my parents, I really feel the need to just say, you're welcome. Because I was not the problem child.
Yeah, you were the good one.
Yeah, that's what I say. That's not what they say.
Right.
they like to remind me of every time I talk to them about something my son's doing, the look they give me is very much, this is payback. Exactly what we went through with you. I recently passed on an heirloom to my son, which was a little placard, a little stand-up thing, which says, I think it says, what, me? It wasn't me. I don't know a thing about it. And that's something my parents gave to me when I was his age.
That's funny.
And I've now passed it on to him.
Right. I got 3 boys. They're all out of the house, all working. But you're 8 and 6. So those are nice ages. I'll give you some advice. Try to stay in as best shape as you can. So you can, you don't want to be one of those like dads that sits on the couch because you're too tired to get up.
Well, it's a good thing this is an audio podcast because no one out there can see how true that is. I am out of shape. I've got a bad back. So it is something I'm working on to all our listeners out there.
It's well worth it. It's well worth it. Because you want to be able to run with them and play with them and do everything. And you don't want to hear, come on, Dad.
I mean, Philip and I, when we're traveling to gigs and whatever, no one sounds more like 2 old Jews. Oh, my back hurts. Oh, my head hurts. Oh, I'm tired.
I did a joke about Obamacare. And I didn't do politics, but this was kind of, I said, you know what Obamacare is, right?
Mm.
Yeah.
I said, Obamacare, they said that he did it because he wanted something where people who had pre-existing conditions could get insurance. And I said, every Jew is born with a pre-existing condition. Jews are born, my head hurts, my feet are swollen, I get my earache. So I just whole thing about how Jews are always, even from the day they're born, their back is out.
I think it's good practice for when we're in the home.
Yeah, that's right. Well, that's right.
But also that's quite interesting because when we were expecting our first child, I read a few of the books you're supposed to read. And one of the things they talked about in one of, I can't remember which it was, quite a flighty, flaky sort of book, did say that, babies cry. But one of the things it may well be is that when they're first born, they probably have a headache because of everything that they've gone through in the birth. And I was just thinking, that is the most Jewish baby, isn't it? To come out, your first kind of introduction to the world, and it's like, oh, my head. Oh, keep it down. Keep it down, guys.
First word out of a Jewish baby, does anybody have a baby Tylenol?
Oh, bless.
One other question we'd like to ask you is, we always like to find out about some of the relationships that people have in their lives. All Jews know each other. That's kind of a myth that is often proven to be true, actually. But we like to find out if any of our guests have any particular special Jewish connections with, could be celebrities, it could be a family member who happened to invent something amazing back in the day. We call this 6 degrees of can't eat bacon. And right. We wondered if you had any particular Jewish connection. Obviously, we know you're touring with Seinfeld and you're working with other Jewish comedians as well, but anyone else?
Something more personal.
Right. So there was one person in our family they talked about a lot. If you Google Polaroid Land.
Polaroid Land, like the country of Polaroids.
No, Polaroid. There's a Polaroid camera. Have you ever heard of that? Mm-hmm. Polaroid. There was a camera called the Polaroid Land camera.
Yeah, mm-hmm. It comes up on Google.
Okay, Land was one of the inventors of the camera. He was an uncle.
Edwin H. Land.
Yeah.
Is this the one?
I don't know that much about him, but he was quite the entrepreneur and inventor. My mother always talked about him, even sent her a camera once or something. Somebody sent her, from his company, sent everybody in the family camera. So Lan was a relative. But my family were Jews from the Bronx, kind of poor. My parents were not immigrants. My father's parents were born in America, but my grandparents came from Russia and Poland and Hungary. Nobody famous, nobody, most of them really uneducated. My grandfather was a shamus. He would sit with the dead bodies at night, and he would play pinochle on the coffin by himself, or he would play cards by himself on top of the coffin. One time, he got separated somehow during a funeral with the body, and he was racing to the cemetery, and a cop pulled him over and said, "What's the hurry? Guy in the back's not going anywhere." No, but nobody really famous in the family. I'm the first person to ever, you know, be in show business and have any sort of little name and stuff like that, any marquee stuff, but nothing.
How did your family feel about you going into comedy?
Well, when I first told them when I was really young, like a teenager, they just thought it was another, you know, oh, you know, little boys want to be cowboys, firemen, this and that. They never knew anybody, like probably your family. They never knew anybody who did this. So my mother was more worried than my father. But then when they started seeing that I was getting some work and doing some, it took me 5 years before I started making any money at all. I worked for free for 5 years at the showcase clubs, but I had no education. I basically finished school in fifth grade. I was done. I had it. I was like an ADD kid, you know, one of those guys. I couldn't sit still. I couldn't pay attention. I didn't like any of my teachers. I didn't like anything that they were teaching me. I wouldn't do any homework. The teacher used to say to me, "Mark, this is what we'll do. Just sit there with your hands folded and we'll give you a zero at the end of the semester." And that's the way I lived. But I used to cut school and go to Broadway plays and different plays and ballets and operas, and go to the library and read. So a lot of my education is self-education.
We've had very similar backgrounds because I used to also do that. It was always truanting from school. I've also had undiagnosed ADHD and dyslexia and dyscalculia and all this other stuff. Yeah. And but I used to go with my friends. I used to go to the theatre and to comedy clubs. So right. I didn't spend so much time in the library, I'll be honest, but I did other stuff.
I used to like to go to a place called Lincoln Center, the library, and different libraries, and I would just stay home by myself. My parents worked, so I had the house to myself and lay around and watch some TV and then maybe do some reading. Yeah, I was destined to become a comedian. The right thing.
A lovely expression that you're self-educated. I really like that.
Yeah, I've always, I continue my education now. I mean, you know, going to these lectures and talks and, you know, listening to a lot of podcasts to learn things. It helps. You know, I heard this guy today, a friend, this guy I know, he's like 85 and he goes, you know, I'm not doing much with my life. I play some pinochle, I take a nap, I have something to eat. I don't want a life like that. You know, it's right. No. Really? One of the great things about writing. If you're a writer, you can keep doing it forever. You may not sell it. You know, Carl Reiner, the great Carl Reiner, he was writing novels, books, 95 years old.
Yeah. Well, please God by you.
I'm trying. Eretz Hashem.
So the next question is about Jewish words, Jewish language and Yiddish and things like that. We like to call this section Duolingo. And we want to know if you had a particular favorite, something that you use on a regular basis.
I'm just completely blocked now with that. It's, I like when people come over the house, I say, Zetzachavek.
What's that?
Zetzachavek, please sit down. Relax. That's Yiddish. Zetzachavek.
Zetzachavek.
Yeah. You have a Yiddish translation thing there?
No, I believe you. I'm not double checking. Oh, yeah, I just like haven't heard.
Zeigesund.
Zeigesund is lovely. Go in good health.
Yeah. May your neshama have an aliyah.
Oh, that's a sad one. That's RIP, basically, isn't it?
Yeah, but it's nice. You know, when if somebody believes in that and you say it to them, I think it's meaningful. Mm.
So the words I understood from that was neshama is soul. Is that?
Yeah.
All right. And then aliyah was your soul going.
When somebody passes on and it's their Yetzirit, right? It's the anniversary of the death.
The Yahrzeit, yeah.
Yeah, your side. So you'll say to them, may your father's neshama have an aliyah. May he rise higher in this heavenly sphere, maybe.
Yeah. You Let me ask a question, actually. Not that we haven't interrogated you for ages now. In America, do people use the expression, please God by you?
Every once in a while.
Right.
Isn't Baruch Hashem?
It's not quite the same thing, because I think there's a passive aggressive layer to wishing someone please God by you. You know, like for example, when I was still single and in about dinosaur ages, and if I was at someone's engagement party, when everyone would come up and go, please God by you, please God by you. But there's also like it's a kind of good wish, let that happen to you in the future, may you also get engaged. But it's also like a veiled criticism of the fact you're not engaged yet.
Right. You don't hear that too much here. I've heard it. It's in there with the creek don't rise, God willing, I'll see you Wednesday.
Yeah. I'm curious about it because it's in my new show. It's about being a Jewish mother. And I'm exploring that expression a little bit in the show. And then someone said to me, someone American, said they're not used to hearing it. And I thought, oh, I thought that was quite an international thing. Well, that's nearly all we've got time for. But how will our audience know what you're up to if you never call and you don't write? Normally, we'd allocate 20 seconds to do this, but for you, 30.
So they can find me, markschiff.com, markschiff.com. My podcast, You Don't Know Schiff. You can find me there. You can find me on Instagram. You can find me on Amazon. My book is on Amazon. Why Not? Lessons on Comedy Courage, Chutzpah. So I'm kind of all over the place. If you look at my website, you'll see my dates. Go under the dates and you'll see all the dates I have with Jerry Seinfeld and all the other dates I'm doing. So I got a lot going on.
Amazing.
Is your other book also still available on Amazon?
Yes, it is. I Killed, True Stories of the Road by America's Top Comics. I got everybody here from Larry David to Chris Rock to Jay Leno to Paul Reiser, George Lopez, Tom Arnold, Drew Carey, Brett Butler, Jerry Seinfeld, Joan Rivers. Got them all here. In fact, you know, it's interesting. I called comedians in England because I tried to get some English comedians and I couldn't really get any stories. I thought I maybe had one here, but no, I couldn't get anybody from England to give me any of these stories for the book.
Well, you never asked either of us. You could have had stories from us.
Yeah, no, I didn't know you. I didn't. I wish I knew That's you back right. then.
Volume two.
I Still Killed.
This book took, yeah, I Killed.
I Killed Again.
Yeah, which is what, you know, comedians say. People go, how'd it go last night? I killed him. Yeah. Right? So isn't that what you guys say on your side of the pond?
Sometimes. Yeah. I killed yeah. is I smashed it is a very common expression here.
I murdered them. I killed them. I slaughtered them.
Yeah, the list of lies goes on.
It's very aggressive.
I think it is very aggressive. I took the roof off.
Yeah, no, I blew the roof off. Yeah. I mean, the whole thing, it's very violent.
Well, I've absolutely loved this. And from now on, I'll always think of Mark Schiff as the Jew whose wife can hear him from the next room as he slowly heats his hummus.
There you go.
Great. And as my grandmother used to say when she wanted to end my telephone call, you must have better things to do than talk to me, and you must have better things to do than talk to us, which is a good thing, as sadly we've come to the end of this week's show. We'd like to thank our guest, the hilarious Mark Schiff. Follow him on social media.
Follow us on social media at Jew Talking without the G.
Don't forget to subscribe, like and share with everyone you know,
and join us next time on Jew Talking to Me.
Jew Talking to Me was hosted by me, Philip Simon.
And me, Rachel Krieger.
It was produced by Russell Balkin and judged by our mothers.
So that's everything for this week. We will be back next week with another episode. Don't forget that Rachel and I will both be at the Edinburgh Festival in August. And you can find out more about our shows on our respective websites.
Are you going to try the hot hummus?
I'll be honest with you. It feels a bit like putting chips back in the microwave when they've already had ketchup or mayonnaise on the plate. I'm not sure where I stand on cooking condiments.
Yeah, I'm with you.
But I will be trying his recipe for hummus, though.
Well, then you have to remember to email and thank him.
All right, maybe I won't try it. I don't like small talk.